Good evening, everybody. My name's Caroline Arscott, and I'm the chair for tonight's panel discussion. I just thought that I would explain to you the structure of the way that we'll take the discussion this evening. First of all, I'm just going to introduce you to our panelists. Once I've done that, then Tim Clark will come and give us a brief introduction to our discussion. He'll be followed by Lisa Tickner, who will continue with a short presentation. After Lisa, Ross McKibben will be speaking briefly, and then finally, Anne Wagner will round up the short presentations from the panel. At that point, I'll be inviting the panel to embark on some interactive discussion, and we'll see how we can get the discussion going. And then, at a certain point, we'll bring in questions and contributions from the audience. There's going to be a radio mic circulating around. So that'll take us, I think, happily into the depths of Lowry and through this evening's session. Let me just say a few words about our panelists. We're extremely delighted to have both curators of the current exhibition here. First of all, let me introduce Anne Wagner, who is an art historian who was for a long period based at University of California in Berkeley from 1988 to 2010, and she remains there as the class of 1936 chair emerita. Currently, she is a visiting professor at the Courtauld. We're delighted at the Courtauld to welcome her into this role. And her work is extremely widely known. She's published in Art Forum, Representations, October, the Threepenny Review, and her books are key reference points for us all. Her volume on Carpeaux, published in 1986, and the Three Artists, Three Women of 1996, and then in 2005, Motherstone, The Vitality of Modern British Sculpture, came out. Most recently, her collection of essays, A House Divided on Recent American Art, came out in 2012. She's working currently on Behaving Globally, which is a book commissioned by Princeton University Press for the series Essays on the Arts. So Anne will be the final speaker, and we're moving along the row. Next to Anne is Ross McKibben, who is the Emeritus Research Fellow from St. John's College, Oxford. And Ross is a historian whose work concentrates on the period between 1880 and 1960, and on British political and social history. He's known for his work on the early Labour Party, and he has moved more recently into social and cultural history. Currently, his current project is on the development of British youth culture from the outbreak of World War II to 1960. So, keeping along the row, we now come to Lisa Tickner. Lisa is currently visiting professor at the Courtauld, where she teaches an MA on British modernism. She was for a long period at the University of Middlesex, and she's known for her work on early 20th century British art, and indeed on 19th century British art. She's the co-editor of 4 collections on visual culture, most recently the editor with David Peters Corbett of British Art in the Cultural Field, 1939 to 1969, which came out in 2012. Her current research is focused on the London art world of the 1960s. Lisa's work on Sickert and other artists of the earlier 20th century has really transformed the field. Finally, at the end of the row, is the other curator of the Lowry exhibition, T.J. Clark. Tim was also, for a long period, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and he's now the George C. and Helen N. Pardee Chair Emeritus. His work in art history has certainly changed the nature of the discipline from his very early publications on French art, The Absolute Bourgeois of 1973, The Image of the People on Courbet in 1973, and then The Painting of Modern Life, Paris in the Art of Manet and His Followers of 1984. His very broad-ranging Farewell to an Idea of 1999 dealt with the whole trajectory from the French Revolution forward in the history of art. And he has most recently published Picasso and Truth from Cubism to Guernica in 2013. So we have a terrific panel. I'm going to hand over to Tim now to start off the discussion.
I want to say thank you very much to Caroline for the introduction and to Sonia and Anna for organizing things. And also a huge thank you, which I know Anne will want to join me to Helen Little, who's here this evening, who was our absolutely indispensable co-curator, in-house curator at Tate for the show. It just wouldn't have remotely happened without her. Anne and I both thought that it made sense for us to get the discussion started this evening with one or two brief reflections that have emerged from doing the Lowry show. Anne is deep in the sculptural world of the American Charles Ray at the moment, working to meet a deadline for an essay about him. She'll have plenty to say, I've no doubt, in our informal discussion, but we agreed that I should kick the session off. What I go on to present now owes everything to the conversations we've had over the past months. Lowry, we've argued in the exhibition, is preeminently a painter of the industrial scene. This is him at his characteristic best, I think, the football match of 1949. And we might even shift the emphasis away from the term painter of the industrial scene here and simply say that he's that rarity, a visual artist in the 20th century who made it his job to investigate systematically the look of the extraordinary world human beings made for themselves as a result of industrialization. It turns out that depicting this look of the world of industry posed special problems for visual art, and that visual art instinctively flinched from the problems and by and large avoided the subject, notably perhaps in Britain, but in many other industrial nations as well. The look of industry is a look that art found hard to look in the face. Why this was so is a hard problem. But here are two aspects of the case that may help us with the way Lowry specifically went about it. I'll put them to you, not first with Lowry directly in view, but instead the achievement of the two great German photographers of the 1950s and 60s, Hiller and Bernd Becker, who set themselves the task of memorializing the fast-vanishing physical fabric of early 20th century industry in Europe and the United States. I mean, of course, most of all in Germany, but very far from being only in Germany. They made photographs in the northeast of England and in Scotland and in the United States and elsewhere. Two things are striking. The Beckers seem very soon to have realized that a central fact about the world of industrialization, as they explored it, was that it had produced a universe of standardized repetition. There were inevitably all kinds of variations within the new standard types. Human beings don't deal in absolute duplication. But what art had to find form for was the standardized nature of things. The Beckers' relentless deadpan grids, their so-called typologies, was one main way of making the look of a mass-produced world become salient on the wall of a gallery. But on its own, this wouldn't account for the strange power, the strange otherness, but an otherness we immediately recognize as familiar, of the Beckers' photographs. The other part of the Beckers' equation has to do with where we stand, or maybe better, where we do not stand, in relation to the object world they are charting. It has to do, and here's where Lowry looms close, I think, with an uncanny kind of distance that the camera seems to assume. A weird kind of neutrality or objectivity, a refusal, as it were, to take a stance in relation to the world industrialization has left behind. The camera looks at this world as if from a deep outside. We could say, adopting an older and often agonized vocabulary, that the camera is alienated from it. But there is no agony involved in the Beckers. The camera has no feelings about the fact that the world it shows is not human, and it's as if it wants us to adjust ourselves to this non-humanness. I don't think, by the way, that this means that the Beckers' photography is soulless. On the contrary, I think it's drenched by a feeling for the pathos and unlikeliness of the new world of non-human things. But there's an immense difference between a feeling for the world's specific pathos and a confident sympathy for it, or a shiver at its ugliness, or a pity for its dereliction. Feeling about the industrial world, the Beckers suggest, feeling as opposed to sentiment, can only come from a kind of outsidedness, which in the end is truly a mimesis of the outsidedness to their own built world of the industrial world's actual inhabitants. I think the Beckers help us to look at Lowry. What Lowry soon saw to be the real challenge to painting presented by the industrial scene was how to deal with sameness and standardization and dull repetition. They hadn't, in his view, to be given a plangent philanthropic treatment. In this sense, he was a modernist through and through. What painting or the camera could register about the world was its look, its shape, its structure. The eye or the lens should admit, almost dramatize, its mere looking, its outsidedness, its distance from the feeling of what happens. But as with the Beckers, once you get accustomed to the narrow range of variations allowed by Lowry's idiom, the variations begin to register. I should say all the more powerfully for being, as they are in life, small and hard won. There is a massive sameness to Lowry's world, but difference within the sameness is irrepressible. People, as part of a crowd or a class, look uniform, and uniformity is an important part of their life and life chances. It may even be flaunted. But something in these streets, to echo a famous early Lowry title, is always going wrong. Accidents happen, fights break out, crowds gather and disperse, a strike meeting one day, an eviction another. Lowry's art, we might say, is constantly feeling for the unique balance in industrial society between repetition and event. Sad events, comic or trivial ones, tragic, insubordinate, events almost over before they take place. The unreproducible fragility of an accident, terrible slide, but no slide is any good. The unreproducible fragility of an accident is typical, where you try to see the poor woman's body just dragged from the canal, but never quite can, and the terrace houses in the middle ground are about as far from the cliché of warm working-class community as ever an artist has dared to go. One last word about the Lowry compared to the Beckers. You'll understand that part of what is special about the Beckers' great map of the industrial landscape, and I think the same goes for Lowry, is that it refuses the grand view. Time and again, the Beckers place us at a determinate distance from one particular object. Often, Lowry does the same. Lowry is so fascinated by the peculiarity of the built forms that come from industrialization, these extraordinary looming roofs in the foreground of the football match are typical. Inevitably, we get interested in the glimpse we are given of these objects' wider surroundings. And a lot of the Beckers photo's pathos comes from what we see and infer here. But industrialization does not have, in these photos, an overall shape. It's built from exchangeable parts. It's not a totality. But artists cannot resist totality. Seeing the world as a whole is what they are after, however much they pretend otherwise. Call it a temptation or an aspiration as you like. The Beckers are no exception. There we go. Repeatedly, they happen on a corner of the landscape of industry. This one's in Alabama, actually, which they cannot resist presenting as a tragic scene, an epitome, a strange wonder and wilderness. I think of the lovely phrase from Lowry himself, thinking back to his night rambles across the hills to Bolton, hearing the thump of the mine machinery underground and, quote, thinking and thinking of the mystery of it all. Here's my last brief comment by way of conclusion. There has been in 20th century art what Anne and I would call a picturesque of industrialization. It's been bound up with a fascination with industry's debris and deterioration and wastage and ruin, what Marxists used to call capitalism's continual crisis of overproduction. Collage, the art of debris and discarded bits and pieces, is central to this picturesque. The Beckers are not free from it, as the wrecked car bodies in the foreground, that cliche of Americanness, makes clear. When Lowry eventually decided to totalize, to try to show on a large scale the whole truth of his industrial world, of course he too could not avoid the appeal of ruin and enormity. Impossible picture to photograph, actually. This is the first of the large-scale industrial landscapes, the one now in Leicester, the one done for the Festival of Britain. And for some reason or other, I just think that the picture I took when it was just still propped on the floor during the hang gets its strange color sort of a bit more right than most other pictures we have of it. So, not for a moment am I claiming that when Lowry painted panoramically, he could possibly avoid the appeal of ruin and enormity. But I want to claim, for the five extraordinary big landscapes in room six, that what's truly unique about them is their ability to show the end of industry, that much-touted thing called deindustrialization, which perhaps had been from the start part of industrialization, a necessary aspect of the process's essential ruthlessness, its continual destruction and reconstruction of productive powers. The ability to show all this without losing hold of his art's indispensable plainness and matter-of-fact. The world of industry in Lowry is not picturesque, I feel, or picturesque in a very peculiar way. And the sense of its ending is certainly not sublime. It may be ghastly or ghostly. Look at the mid-ground swamps in the Leicester picture, and I can show you a